Barry Jones is an Australian polymath, writer, teacher, lawyer, social activist, quiz champion, and former politician. He campaigned against the death penalty throughout the 1960s, particularly against the execution of Ronald Ryan. Barry is on the National Trust's list of Australian living treasures. Barry, you've written a great deal about the impact of music in your life, but also more broadly, about the role of complexity in expanding brain function. Music is a language with an almost infinite set of variables. Please, tell me more.
Well, the thing that has always struck me, and I suppose because of my childhood and having some kind of exposure to what I'd regard as serious, complex music anyway, largely through the ABC, but also to some extent through family connections, because my grandmother was quite a distinguished singer and my mother was a very accomplished player with some reservations. But it meant that right from the beginning I was exposed to music that was complex and represented a challenge of some sort. But I also understood, as I read more and more about the history of human development and the fact the way in which language evolved, for example, it starts from simple cries for help or cries for communication, or it moves on to singing. At first, it's very, very simple, like messages of where is my child, or where is the food, or where do I get water. But then later on, you see, we start to think about the abstract. We start to think about concept. And if you start to think about that, then you've got to use a different kind of language. And it's got to be a more complex language. Now, we can get along. It's clear that we can communicate at some sort of level, you know, with a vocabulary of perhaps even a few hundred words. There's a kind of an assumption that people's concentration span runs for about 2.5 minutes. And after 2.5 minutes, really, you're lost. So what you tend to do with a great deal of popular music is something that's very familiar, that's repeated a great deal. There's not a great deal of variation. The result is that after a while, you've got the comforting sense, if you go to a mass concert or you go to a football stadium where they're singing the club song, to say, oh, I feel wonderful. Everyone knows this. We're all familiar. We're all reinforcing each other like mad. But that reinforcement is really only operating for a very short period, the 2.5 minutes. After that, people start to drift away. Well, the way in which the brain develops and the complexity of our brain depends to an extraordinary extent on the mastery of language and the mastery of complexity. If we haven't got that mastery of complexity and the understanding just what it is that human beings are capable of, you tend to assume that people are going to operate at an absolutely basic level. I'm sorry I've rattled on for so long, and I've certainly gone far over a 2.5 minute concentration span, but I'm concerned about the development of the brain at the highest level.
Art, music and stuff like that is a protective factor against maybe cognitive decline.
Oh, I think that's right. And the thing that I find so depressing, often distressing about, say, modern political life, is that a number of our political leaders, who shall remain nameless perhaps just for the moment, is that they seem to be totally lacking in curiosity. They're obsessed with the familiar. That's something that they see every day. And they look always for that reinforcement so that you have the repetition endlessly of the same kind of slogans, that you talk in mantras, that you don't express a concept that is conceptual, you don't express a concept that it might be abstract and that may have an ethical basis. It's really a matter of saying, in effect, I'll put more money in your pockets. I'll give you security. We'll get you money. That seems to me to be a kind of debasement of what human beings are capable of. Just to raise a few matters of political history, and I know we're not really talking fundamentally about politics, but if you look back to some of our very significant figures in the past, take Ben Chifley, Joseph Benedict Chifley, who was Prime Minister immediately after the war and who was the treasurer of Australia during the war and in the post-war years. If you read Chifley's speeches, and if you think very seriously, but you think, well, he must have been, you know, must have had a very superior education. Well, in fact, you see, he left school when he was 12, I think, and everything that he had was self-educated. You had a whole collection of people in an earlier generation, not true now, but you had an earlier generation of people who were what we called autodidacts, people who really taught themselves. They had left school early because of financial pressures. It was very difficult for them to keep on. Often, of course, well, invariably, no one else in the family had ever undertaken tertiary education or had any kind of professional qualification. So it meant that they had to struggle towards self-improvement. Well, I was lucky. You see, I was in that in-between period that I was the first member of my family to go on to university. But I had the advantage of having a very superior secondary education, going to Melbourne High School, which was really was the kind of peak school in Melbourne, and then going on to Melbourne University. So I was one of those who was a real beneficiary of changes in the system. The people who were a decade or so older than me, they didn't have those advantages. And the other thing, too, of course, was that so many of the people in that decade immediately before me had been old enough to serve in the war. And a lot of them had come back damaged, either physically or psychologically damaged. When they came back, they were determined to make a really very serious contribution to Australian public life. They wanted to transform the education system. And they wanted to warn children of my age to say, you've got to create a different kind of world, a better kind of world, where the kind of horrors that we've seen in World War II never happen again. We've got to say that there hasn't been a world war in that very, very long period after 1945. A lot of horrific wars in specific regions, and of course the Middle East has been an area of terrible conflict and danger and horror over a matter of decades, but it hasn't been global. And when you talk to people, say, even in their 30s or 40s, and you talk to them about the things that I can just remember, like the end of the Great Depression and like the Second World War and so on, their eyes glaze over when you mention it because it's completely outside their experience. They have no collective memory because what do those names mean? You raise a name like Hitler and there's only the faintest flicker of recognition of people who say, oh yes, I understood what Hitler was all about, the forces that drove and created Hitler. When you talk about Stalin, for example, Stalin was almost a forgotten name. You'd talk to a lot of otherwise very intelligent, well-informed people, say in their 40s and 50s, the name Stalin doesn't mean anything.
Well, I suppose for all of us, eventually everything is forgotten.
Including ourselves.
Indeed. And I wanted to ask you about something about yourself, because you have a powerful response to art. Can you explain to us Stendhal syndrome?
Well, Stendhal was a great French novelist, extraordinary French novelist, who wrote the two great works, The Charterhouse of Parma and Scarlet and Black, very well worthwhile reading. But he was also a kind of quasi-diplomat. And he had a particular experience in Florence in 1817, and he walked into the Church of Santa Croce, and that's a very interesting church where you've got a whole series of monuments, including the tombs of Michelangelo, of Machiavelli, I can mention a couple of other forgotten names, Rossini, the composer, and they've got a space there where they hope that Dante might one day have his remains returned from Ravenna, where he died, to Florence, where he lived and worked. Unlikely that's going to happen. But somehow he was completely overcome by the beauty of the church, the significance of the tombs, the artwork generally, and he found this overpowering sense of really getting the shakes, getting the trembles, that his breathing pattern changed. He was short of breath. He felt his heart going bang, bang, bang. It's a phenomenon which psychologists later on have called Stendhal syndrome. He didn't coin the term himself, but it's often called Stendhal syndrome. Well, I'm a lifelong sufferer from Stendhal syndrome, because so often when I've been into a place, often it's a cathedral, often, of course, it'll be a great art gallery, or it might be a physical manifestation. It might be an extraordinary place of beauty, like the Iguazu Falls in South America, or Machu Picchu in Peru, or it could be the Grand Canyon in the United States. And suddenly, you have this overpowering sense of the beauty, the extraordinary complexity of what it is that you're seeing, and it's life-transforming. And I have that experience very, very often. So I'm a lifelong sufferer from Stendhal syndrome, and I think it gets more acute as I get older. Because often if I go to a great cathedral, and I think, well, this is probably like at my great age, it's likely to be the last time that I ever see it. And often when I've gone to a place, you sometimes get this paradoxical effect, which is part of Stendhal syndrome, that you may be going to a place for the very first time. You've never set foot in it, and yet, strangely, there's something about it that seems familiar. You feel as if you've known it all your life. And it's extraordinarily difficult to explain. You can only experience it. And I remember some years ago, in fact, I think it might have been, when I think back now, it was probably on my 60th birthday, which is a long time ago. But I was in a town in Germany called Trier, very interesting town, which used to be one of the Roman capitals over there in the area not far from Cologne. And I went into this church for the very first time called St. Gandalf's Church. Now, that's a name that will mean something to people who have read Lord of the Rings. And when I went in, the organist was playing the fugue from a famous fugue by Bach, the Prelude and Fugue in E minor, subtitled The Wedge Fugue. And suddenly, I just felt that my life was transformed. He was at one of those great turning points in life, experiencing something in a church I'd never been in, and then hearing a work that I was very familiar with. And suddenly, for about half an hour anyway, I made sense of my own life. I wouldn't pretend to make sense of it every day of the week or every month of the year, but there are sometimes these extraordinary moments when you think, I'm never going to experience something like this ever again, and it's infinitely precious.
Barry Jones, thank you very much for joining us today on Nostalgia Town.
Thank you.